is a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy.
Eat right, exercise, keep your weight down, lower your stress levels, don't worry, be happy. Think those are some of the keys to a long life? Think again. It turns out some of the folk wisdom and health advice we've been getting about how to ensure a long life may not be what it's about all after all. Our guests today have collaborated on a unique research study following the lives of 1,500 Californians over the period of 80 years. They analyzed what character traits are most likely to lead you to a long life, and the answers may surprise you. Howard Friedman is a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of California in Riverside. He is a fellow of the American Psychological Association and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's the author of The Self-Healing Personality and co-author of the new book, The Longevity Project. Welcome to the show, Howard.
My pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Leslie Martin. She's a professor of psychology at La Sierra University and research psychologist at the University of California, Riverside. She is co-author with Howard of The Longevity Project. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Thank you so much.
Question for our listeners. Are you old? Do you come from old stock? What are your secrets or your family secrets to living to a ripe old age? What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Howard and Leslie, your studies have uncovered a series of what you call dead-end myths. What do you mean by that dead-end myth phrase? And give us some examples. Howard?
Well, the people think that certain things you always hear about will make you live longer and stay healthy. But we found when we looked across 8 decades following a large number of people throughout their whole lives from the time they were children, different things became relevant. So certain patterns were more important. And so the myths that people hear about really lead to dead ends in more than one sense of the term. For example, you always hear, take it easy, don't work so hard, and you'll stay healthier. Big myths. Our results really clearly show that those who were highly motivated and worked the hardest and steadily advanced in their careers and achieved the most career success, those are the people who tended to stay healthy and live the longest.
What are some other examples, Leslie?
Well, another one that you often hear is that, you know, worrying is really bad for you and that you can really worry yourself to death or cause a lot of problems with that stress and anxiety. And while certainly you can worry too much, what we found in the Longevity Project is that a moderate amount of worrying can actually serve you well, and it's not always a bad thing. So that's something where the common advice is really overly simplistic and the reality across the lifespan is much more complicated. Another common thing that you hear is that it's good to be very optimistic and cheerful, and that's your best approach. But what we actually found in the Longevity Project is that the most cheerful and optimistic kids actually live substantially shorter lives than their less optimistic counterparts. And that was really surprising to us because there are a number of studies that have shown the positive benefits of being optimistic. But what you see is that, again, in the short term, that's often true, particularly if you're facing a crisis. It's good to believe that positive things can happen and that things will get better. That keeps you engaged in the process of making that happen. But if your approach every day to every decision and everything you encounter is, oh, it's going to be fine, you know, life is great, I don't need to worry about anything, that can lead you to make decisions and evaluate risks in ways that are cumulatively not necessarily good for you.
My guests are Leslie Martin and also Howard Friedman, both psychology professors at University of California, Riverside, research psychologists there at the University of California, Riverside. We are talking about their new book. It's called The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk a little bit about the distinction between causation and correlation and how that works, fits into this study.
Well, in a lot of research, you can't do the kind of true experiment in this area, because you can't take a bunch of people and assign them to a certain personality and then follow them, and you can't tell some people to smoke and some people not to smoke and then see who gets sick. So you really have to come at it in a very complicated kind of way. So that's why the Longevity Project is so unique, because it's the only study that has followed people in detail from the time they were children till the time they died. And so we're able to look what relates earlier in life to what relates in early adulthood, and then into later adulthood, and then into old age. And so we're able to tease apart through a lot of sophisticated analyses what is kind of leading to what. And one of the interesting findings was, it's not such a good idea to pick apart one single risk factor after another single risk factor. Rather, it's really important to look at patterns. So we found that people who were on the right pathway often had good things happen later on in their lives, and they stayed healthier. And people who fell off the right healthy pathways, which we detail we explain in quite much detail in the book, they tended to have one bad thing happen to another. So if you were conscientious, and if you got a good education, and if you had friends and good ties to other people, and you succeeded in your careers, these all things went together. You couldn't do one at a time. They kind of one led to the other. And though that anyone who was on that pattern really lived significantly longer. And I should say, we're not talking here about some people here, they hear longevity, they think, well, I don't care, I don't want to live to 120. We're really talking here about why some people thrive into their 70s and 80s, and other people succumb in their 40s and 50s and 60s. So it really is something that's relevant to almost everyone.
And you do talk, and I love the word, you talk about individuals with certain constellations of habits and patterns of living. And you also make the point that things can change, too. It's not a fixed constellation.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, particularly because some of the best predictors that we identified in the Longevity Project are personality characteristics. And people often think that, you know, your personality is what it is, and you can't change it, and that's what you're stuck with. And although certainly there is a good deal of stability in personality, that often is because people don't make an effort to change. And changing personality is something that takes a good deal of time, and it's not easy. But things can be adjusted and moved in the appropriate direction. So if, for example, you took one of the quizzes, we have a lot of self-quizzes and things in the book, and you recognize that, you know, oh, this isn't quite exactly where I wanted to be, there are things that you can do, some of them relatively easy, others that take a lot more work, but things that you can do to sort of move yourself in the direction that you want to be. And so I think that's a very encouraging message for people.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think when people ask us, well, what can I do? Well, we say, well, fill out the quizzes in the book and kind of plot out your own profile so you can see what kind of pattern you have, and do it to your friends too, and have them rate you on the scales, and then you can kind of see what your trajectory is. And so there's no quick fix, and not, you know, one tip I can give you today and then all of a sudden you're going to live forever. But people who are serious can get a sense of where they're heading and make changes gradually, and then it makes a big difference, really. You're talking about the people who can thrive later in life.
The first quiz, towards the front of the book, is about conscientiousness. I took the quiz. I scored 39 out of 50, which is a little above average. But what about conscientiousness?
Well, conscientiousness was the biggest personality predictor that we identified, and that's true both for childhood and adulthood. And interestingly, these measures that the participants in the Longevity Project took were not exactly the same in childhood and adulthood. In childhood, it was parents and teachers that were rating these kids. In adulthood, they were self-reports, but they all focus in on important elements of being prudent and forward-thinking and having a lot of stick-to-itiveness. You know, you start something and you really persisting and go after that. So these important elements of conscientiousness. And what we saw is that these really serve people well over the long term. These individuals are those who are experiencing greater stability in a lot of areas of their lives. They tend to have stable and rewarding careers. And this personality trait sort of sets in motion a whole, like you said, constellation of other positive events and characteristics that often go hand in hand with that. So it was an incredibly important one.
I want to get into more about the study later, but before we move on, I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea that these were handpicked kids. They were from middle, upper middle. They were smart. They were first picked for being precocious and smart, or appearing to be. There was a certain group of people, and it's natural to wonder, how does that apply to the rest of us? And how does it apply to the broader population when it was such a really an, it was a lot of kids, but it was a narrow sample that way?
Well, that's a very good question. And, of course, we were very concerned about that. So we spent a lot of time looking at those issues. And if you don't have access to any health care and you're living in abject poverty, our findings are not the most important thing to you. You know, you need to get enough food and shelter and those kinds of things. But we're talking about, for most, it was a very much a middle-class sample of Americans during the 20th century. And if you think about the variables we were investigating, individual differences in personality and in their marriages and social relations and in their careers, they varied quite a bit. So just like the general population, it's quite a lot of variation. And so it turned out to be quite helpful to have a group that was did have access to health care and did have the chance to live long. And it could exercise if they wanted to, so we could see which of these other variables really made a difference. And after we started this work 20 years ago, in these past two decades, a lot of researchers have been picking up our findings and seeing if they will repeat or replicate in other samples, and it really seems to be the case. So we're finding some things that are really changing the direction of research in this area of individual differences in social relations and activities and careers and health and longevity, because our findings keep getting replicated.
You point out that most people who live to an old age do so not because they have beaten back some ailment such as cancer or diabetes, but rather because they have avoided the diseases altogether. It's an interesting, subtle distinction in a way, but I also wondered if maybe it's just genetic.
Well, certainly, you know, genes do play a role, but in terms of the aspects that we're looking at, which is not the very, very old, you know, up above 100, the centenarians, but sort of the normal range possibilities for individuals, it's estimated that about a third of the variation in how long people live is attributable to genetics. So certainly that's not meaningless. That said, you've still got a pretty big chunk of variation that's explained by these other personality and psychosocial variables. And so because we weren't able to manipulate and really didn't even have data on the genetics of these individuals, we focused on the other psychosocial and personality elements. And for me, at least, that's really more exciting because that is the stuff that's at least somewhat under our control.
My guests are Leslie Martin. She's a professor of psychology at La Sierra University and research psychologist at University of California, Riverside. She's the co-author with Howard Friedman of the Longevity Project. Howard's also with us. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. He's a fellow of the American Psychological Association and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. If you have a question or comment for them, we're talking about their new book. It's called The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher, and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and be sure to watch Columbus on the Record Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss supporters of Senate Bill 5 looking to cut a deal, downtown Columbus struggles with the side effects of success, and more. Tune in for Columbus on the Record. It's tomorrow night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. 78 degrees at 11:20 this morning. Partly sunny skies today. We'll get up to a high of 87 degrees. Clouds tonight with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, a low of 66 degrees. Partly sunny for Friday, a high of 87. A few clouds Friday night, a low of 65. And looking ahead to Saturday, partly sunny and a high of 84. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a new book. It's called The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study with the co-authors Leslie Martin and Howard Friedman. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Kim. She says, I am 52 and take just vitamins and an aspirin a day, while many of my peers take a handful of prescription drugs every day. My two grandmothers are currently 86 and 90. Both still live independently with the help of their children, so I think I have good genes. Personally, I believe that your outlook plays a large part in both the quality and the length of your life. I try to remain positive. Don't waste time on worry. Laugh a lot and love a lot and avoid negativity. It's working for me. Now, all of this still falls under the rule of thumb that I saw once on a t-shirt and never forgot. Eat right, exercise, get hit by a bus. Have a great, positive day. A little long, but we thought we'd keep the email intact. This idea of a positive outlook is pervasive.
Yeah, and we have a little twist in how to understand that, how to think about that. You know, people always hear that, you know, don't worry, cheer up, go to comedy clubs, stay happy, because thinking happy thoughts reduces stress and leads to long life. And we found that was not really the case. Happier people are healthier, and the person who wrote in, it sounds like she does have a good chance for a long life, a healthy life. But happier people are healthier, our tracking of people for many years revealed that happiness is not the cause of good health. It's true that the people who were on the right track, they tended to do a lot of things that made them both happy and healthy. So it wasn't really a land of laugh therapy and self-esteem clinics and stuff like that. The thrivers, they traveled paths of meaningful, productive living, and that made them both happy and healthy. So a person like that who sent the email probably does a lot of things, being involved with other people or doing meaningful work, helping other people, actually accomplishing something in life, that will keep you happy and it'll also make you healthy.
Yeah, she mentioned her, you know, family members being, you know, old, in their later years in life and having connections and, you know, a lot of interactions with their kids. And that was something that was really important we found in the Longevity Project for individuals who had more contacts with other people, and that could be kids or family, that could be coworkers, it could be friends, but that was really vital. And throughout the years, the individuals who maintained more of those connections and interacted more frequently with other people really tended to do better. So that's so important.
Yeah. Howard? Did you want to add something?
No. Okay.
The full title of your book is The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. There have been other studies about longevity, you say, but how is this different?
Well, the main reason it's different is that it starts in childhood. So the participants were about 10 years old on average. Some of them were even younger when they were recruited back in 1921, or even some of them even a little earlier. And they were followed up every 5 to 10 years throughout their whole lives. And what we've done is we've followed them late in life and then gathered their death certificates so we know exactly when they died and what their cause of death was. And so we have all these kinds of variables in one very large sample of over 1,500 people to see how it all fits together. Some of them are still alive and fit our patterns. We know of one man who is 100, and he fits just what we found in the book. He's still working, and he's still married, and he stays active, but he doesn't run marathons, and he says don't retire. It's a kind of funny thing. We were looking for one of the men who was, we didn't know if he was still alive or if he had died. We couldn't find him, and so we had some students searching, and his name popped up, guess where, on Facebook. So there he is, and with his picture. And so, again, Leslie was just talking about the importance of social ties. Well, here's somebody who's in his late 90s, and he's going on Facebook to maintain ties with other people. So it's really interesting to see all the subtleties and the details that pop out. And speaking of Facebook, we do have a Facebook page for the Longevity Project, which has a lot of links to different things if people want to see that.
All righty, Facebook, Longevity Project. How did you get into this research? It lay dormant for a few years, didn't it?
Well, a number of people have used the project for, you know, relatively small questions, not using the entirety of the data. But about 20 years ago, as we were thinking about, you know, how could we understand better the processes that lead to long life and lead to good health and really have a longitudinal design, you know, we were stuck because if you want to start a study like that now, someone will be able to answer those questions, but it wouldn't be us. We would be dead before that happened. And so we recognize that starting prospectively in childhood and following across a lifespan would be the ideal approach. And when we recognized that, you know, this data set existed, it was not designed to look at health outcomes, but nonetheless, there were some health-relevant data there, and certainly a lot of things about personality and relationships and careers and just all thousands of variables on every single person, we thought, you know, this would be a really great place to try to answer some of our questions. It seems like it would be really easy to do because the data are collected already for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we actually thought that within a year or two, we ought to be able to finish everything up. But the thing is, and you mentioned this earlier, the questions about, you know, how do things change over time? And this was a rather select sample, so how might that be meaningful? And we recognized that we needed to do a lot of very careful validation, make sure that the kinds of pieces of data that we were pulling out of this project were in fact comparable to what researchers and scientists would use today if they were trying to answer these same kinds of questions. So that involved a lot of ancillary studies where we would readminister the same questions that these participants in the 20s and 30s and 40s had taken and give those to contemporary people along with modern measures and look at how those matched up. And so that ended up taking a lot of time and, of course, you know, the death certificate collection and some other bits of data collection. So it became a much more involved process, but we were so fortunate to have access to what is really an incredibly rich set of data.
And it makes me wonder, as you know, there's predictions that our children are going to be the first generation that are not expected as a whole to live longer than the previous generation. There's a lot of there's obesity, there's diabetes, there's a lot of health issues out there now that didn't plague the generations before. Has anyone started a longitudinal study on this generation to follow it forward?
Yes, there have been a lot of things. There's a big national studies trying to study children from before they were born, and there are a lot of different studies that have been started, you know, throughout the second half of the 20th century. So, you know, 50 years from now, we will know a lot more, but it's, you know, we have to rely on what we have now to answer the mm-hmm. questions now. And we also find that people tend to overestimate how much modern medicine is helping. So people are on all these pills and drugs and procedures, and they certainly help improve quality of life, and sometimes they certainly do miraculous cures. But for the average person, they're not really living longer these days because of all kinds of great medical interventions. The big increase in life expectancy in the United States over the last 50 years and has really come from vaccinations and from better health in terms of having cleaner air and better water and better nutrition and disease control, not so much the medical cures. So you're right when you say that as the kinds of things that we've been focusing on, how people behave and how they interact and how much they eat and how much they exercise, start deteriorating, really, people becoming living in a more fragmented society and being more impulsive and not staying active. There will be probably a decrease if that continues in life expectancy.
We had a listener call in, Frank from Clintonville. He said he just wanted to say he's 67 and in great health and attributes this to staying in a routine. Did that pop up on your research?
Well, it's interesting. Conscientiousness, the personality characteristic that we were talking about earlier, does have that as an element. It's one component, certainly not the only defining feature, but having some stability and some routine certainly can be good. Now, to a lot of people, you know, they think, oh, wow, that's so boring. I wouldn't want that. I'd rather live a shorter life and have an exciting life. But what we also saw is that individuals who were conscientious and had stability and routine and planned ahead and stuck to things, because of that quality and because they were trustworthy and they were responsible and reliable, they ended up often having very exciting lives. You know, they had more opportunities, they advanced further in their careers, they got to do a lot of things because they were deemed worthy of that responsibility, and they were able to move in environments that those who were more impulsive and really didn't have that kind of stability often missed those opportunities. So I think that having some routine and some stability certainly is a good thing, and it doesn't mean that you're living a boring life.
And it's probably better for men because we found that married men who were well suited to marriage and stayed in a good marriage, then marriage was really health protective. So that kind of routine was helpful. And for men who got divorced and remained divorced or who remarried and then divorced again, their risk of dying really skyrocketed. But for women, it was very different. Women who stayed single and women who left a poor marriage, like through divorce, they usually thrived. So women were able to have less of a routine, rely more on their friends, while men really depended on their wives for their social life.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are the co-authors of a new book. It's called The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. Howard Friedman and Leslie Martin are with us. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Donald in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I enjoy your show very much. I listen to it every day.
Thank you, Donald.
I wanted to ask your guests if they've heard of telomeres. The lady mentioned that only 30% of our lifespan is determined by heredity. And I've heard recently that you can send away a follicle of hair to be analyzed, and they will send you back the date of your death. And that is based on the telomeres at the end of your genes. Well, apparently, the longer they are, the longer you live. So I was wondering if you can reconcile the 30% and the 100%.
Well, that's an indication of how fast you're aging. And we can give you an estimate of how fast you're aging by using the kinds of psychological and social variables that we're using. So the telomeres are a good predictor of how much you are in your biological age, how far along you are, but that's affected by the kinds of things that we're talking about.
It's not a cause.
Right, it's not fixed that you have certain genes and that tells you the day you're going to live. I mean, you have certain genes that tells you what your eye color is going to be. That's fixed. You know, it doesn't really matter what you do, but your genes, the studies of how of genes and longevity really come from twin studies. Looking over many decades and very large populations, and trying to see how long would they live. And if you think about it, you probably know some people who they're siblings, and so they have similar genes. Or maybe the parents lived a long time of these siblings, and then but some of them die really young, and some of them live really long. So there's certainly a significant genetic component, as Leslie said, but it doesn't come anywhere near to accounting for most of the variation.
And I think it's important to keep in mind, I mean, if genes were in a vacuum and so every single person was living the exact same life and so only the genes had the ability to impact, then sure, you might be able to get to something that's very close to an exact prediction. But we don't live in a vacuum like that. And so we do have behaviors and characteristics and patterns and, buses that can all impact exactly when we will die.
Thanks, Donald, for that call. I appreciate it. We have an email from Jen in Dublin. She writes, I am 48 and am in good health. I often joke with my sisters over wine that I can't afford or want to live too long. Financial experts project that you need to save $250,000 just for health care in retirement. With that in mind, who but the very rich can afford to live a long life? And that makes me wonder, does money have anything to do with it? Wealth.
Well, there is a good correlation between socioeconomic status and longevity. So the kind of higher status, wealthy people do live longer, and people think it's because they have a lot of access to medical care, but we're finding that that's not so much the case. It's the, all these other things that lead people to be successful in their lives that usually make the difference. So clearly, significant poverty is a big threat to your health. But once people are middle class and have some access to health, it doesn't make that much difference how, in terms of the money themselves. It's what you do, how you live your life, really.
And when you're saying it's the kind of the lifestyle you had that led to the wealth, that is what is the longevity is about.
Right. If you think about it, people who are on the right trajectory, they tend to get a good education and they get into good careers and they move ahead in their careers. And why do they do that? Well, they have the same kinds of characteristics that help them in other aspects of their lives. So they're conscientious. They can get into a stable either marriage or other social relationships. They can have friends. They can do things for other people. They can live a meaningful life that we found is really the theme that underlies longevity. Also, that figure, I've heard that too, of $250,000 for medical costs, that's an average. So many people who are on the right trajectory, they don't have any medical costs. They just stay healthy.
Mac in Springfield, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I am on the trajectory for long life in every way, and I'm meeting all your criteria. I'm almost 66, no medications, long-distance runner. I'm meeting all those criteria except for one. I've never really thrived in my career. I've just always been mediocre to underachieving. I'm in sales. And I wonder if there's – am I just a remote exception or is – do you have any insights for me or what?
Well, I think one thing that we can say is that, and we did find that career success is important. It's one of the components. But again, we're talking about constellations and trajectories that involve a lot of different components. So first thing I would say is that if you're on track with the vast majority of them, I wouldn't stress out too much about one or two that may be less ideal. But the other thing is that as we've said, meaning and finding your passion in what you're doing and doing things that really matter to you and that you care about, that's important. And for many people, that comes through their occupation, through their career. But if it doesn't, finding that somewhere else will be really important. And so if you're doing things that benefit others, or if you're doing things that are very important to you, whether that be, volunteering or some sort of community outreach or social activism, things like that can go, I think, a long way toward sort of taking the place of the meaning that maybe you're not finding in a career.
Thank you, Mac, for that call. Yeah?
I was just going to say, he said also that you're a long-distance runner, and we find, activity, of course, is good, but you don't have to overdo it. We found that if you like gardening and walking and cooking and, doing all kinds of things that just get you up and out of your chair, that's really important. So the key for people, especially, entering their 50s and 60s, is to just be doing something. So you don't have to be a marathon runner. You just don't want to be sitting on the couch all day. If you don't like jogging, we say don't jog. Just do the things that you can enjoy and you can keep up. So even tending to your garden or whatever it is that gets you, standing up and walking and moving, we find that that really is a good predictor of health into late life.
I mean, it could be hobbies.
It could probably be
an avocation. It doesn't necessarily mean vocation.
You don't have to set aside a time, each week or each day to go do something. If that's what you're doing, you like woodworking and you do that, and you get tired out, your muscles. We found that that's fine. It was one of the first studies that could look at that over many decades.
Yeah, but the important thing is to do something regularly. And so, absolutely, if you're doing something that you enjoy, you're much more likely to continue doing it consistently over time.
My guests are Leslie Martin and Howard Friedman, co-authors of The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the Landmark 8-Decade Study. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the life of a major league catcher. It's a position that's both physically punishing and intellectually demanding. Brad Ausmus is an Ivy League grad who spent 17 years behind the plate. He'll tell us which foul tips really hurt, what he'd say to a struggling pitcher on a visit to the mound, and how he'd prepare for a collision at the plate. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News, and it's easy to renew your membership. You can visit WOSU.org/renew to make your contribution for another year. Your online renewal means less paperwork for 89.7 NPR News, and that means more of your donation supports the programs you enjoy. And while online, don't forget to set your membership to renew automatically. We can charge your credit card once a year or send you a reminder invoice. It's a quick, easy, and efficient way to show your support and can help reduce on-air fundraising. Visit WOSU.org/renew for more information. And thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 87 degrees. A few clouds tonight, also a chance of showers or thunderstorms, a low of 66. Partly sunny for Friday and a high of 87, a few clouds Friday night, a low of 65. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about a new book. It's called The Longevity Project, Surprising Discoveries for Health and Long Life from the landmark 8-decade study. We're talking about what helps us live longer and what about us indicates a long life with the co-authors Howard Friedman and Leslie Martin. If you have a question or comment for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. One aspect of the book that I found very interesting was the issue of our relationship with our physicians and our the diagnosticians of, you know, modern diagnosticians. You said that personal behaviors used to be more a function of diagnosis, that is, before Louis Pasteur and his associates experimentally proved the existence of infectious microorganisms, germs. And how did that change things in how we look at our health?
Well, physicians do a wonderful job, of course, for emergencies, you know, they all hit by a bus problem, but also any kind of infectious diseases. So the antibiotics have been wonderful, and, you know, we're the first to say with certain kinds of acute conditions, you know, you should be get yourself right into your physician. But those aren't the things for most people that keep them healthy across the long term. The kinds of things that the way they behave their whole lives, and like we talked about earlier, the trajectories that we have, you can help you outline if you look in the Longevity Project book. Those kinds of things are really the kinds of things that lead people to stay healthy or to develop chronic diseases. So if you think about it, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and strokes, and related conditions, and also many cancers, they develop slowly across long periods of time. And this is where the kinds of variables we're talking about in the Longevity Project are most relevant to keep people away from these very serious chronic diseases or minimize the likelihood of them. There are also threats from violence and suicide and so on. One of the participants in the Longevity Project was Douglas Kelly, who was a psychiatrist who was during World War II. He was sent to interview some of the worst Nazi criminals as part of his service in the U.S. Army, and it seemed to really shake him up somehow. Even though he was a very jolly, well accomplished man, talking and seeing what the Nazis had done really seemed to upset him, because More than a decade later, after he left the Nuremberg trials, he swallowed the same kind of cyanide that one of the Nazis he had interviewed had done and killed himself. So there's all kinds of ways that people get off the track. Some of them are violent, and some of them are accidental, and some of them are these kinds of diseases. But you put them all together, it really makes a big difference.
James in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book yet, and I'm very interested in doing so. But my question is, as far as the studies go, how much of it is based on regional situations in the United States and therefore migratory situations, whether, you know, starting out in the North and living in the South later on, and then also the consideration of the gene pool coming from other countries, since this country is based on immigrants, you know, pretty much. I'll hang up and listen on the TV.
On the TV, right. Thanks, James.
Well, the focus of the study was not on migrations, although, as you mentioned before, the participants in the study were pulled from California schools. These were mostly Los Angeles and San Francisco area schools. That said, although the kids started in California, some of them did move out across the U.S., and so we've been able to follow them wherever they ended up. But a primary focus of the study was not to look at regional variations. I think that's something that would be interesting to do. And as we also mentioned earlier, the idea of cross-checking and looking at other studies that take place in other areas of the country or other parts of the world, studies that have different kinds of samples, different sorts of people, more ethnically diverse, et cetera, that's always very important to do. And so we're always very interested when someone else's laboratory is doing similar kinds of work. Thus far, none span the number of decades that the Longevity Project spans, but still it's very interesting and important to look at those. And what we see so far is that the results from the Longevity Project are borne out well in these other sorts of samples in different regions and with different kinds of people.
Jerry called in to mention that two of the oldest people, I don't know them, but they're called Old Caesar and Charity Edwards, they lived to 115, were born into slavery.
I'm not familiar with those individuals.
Evan and Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah. My question was based around the studies and seeing if smoking had any long-term effect. I'm a smoker myself, and I've always enjoyed it. And I was wondering if that showed any significant sign. And I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you, Evan. And it seems like we all know somebody who smokes into very old age, and they say, look at me, I'm not dead yet.
Well, that's true. But basically, we found what most epidemiological studies have found. Smoking is bad. Smoking raises your risk for all kinds of diseases and for premature mortality. So it's one of the worst things you can do for your health is to smoke. That said, some people are protected somewhat, seems biologically, from all kinds of things, and some people are just very unlikely to get cancer biologically. And so, you know, there are people who smoke and live into their 90s and 100s, but that's, you know, you're taking a big risk saying, well, maybe I'm one of those people. That's a very tiny minority. Smoking is really one of the worst things you can do. But it is true that, you know, some of the longest living people do smoke.
What about risk takers? That doesn't necessarily mean they're imprudent or unconscientious. So what about risk takers? Did you look at that at all?
Well, I think it's important to think about what kinds of risks you're taking, and are those, you know, risks with moderation, or are they really sort of crazy risks? One of the things that we see is that individuals who are more conscientious are more thoughtful, and they don't take as many risks. And by the same token, we talked about the optimism and cheerfulness aspect, and we saw that one of the things that was, in fact, happening for the most cheerful, optimistic kids was that they did have riskier hobbies. They tended to be more impulsive and take more risks. So that certainly is a risk factor. That's something that, you know, deserves some care and caution. But it is also the case that if you take calculated risks, you know, risk-taking is not always bad. You can oftentimes have benefits. I myself am probably somewhat of a risk-taker. I'm also highly conscientious, so I try to take those risks carefully and weigh them and not just do everything in my life in a risky fashion. But there has to be a balance.
And captains of industry, people who are very into their, you know, or particularly entrepreneurs, that sort of thing, tend to be risk takers in business.
Yes, but again, most of the time in a calculated way. So
yeah.
Yes, there's a risk, but, you know, you've thought about all of the possible outcomes and you try to have a plan B and a plan C. And so it is risk taking, but with a plan.
Right. It's really being impulsive is a problem.
It's the impulse. Okay. Edith in Granville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. I wanted to add something that I have learned along the way I turned 90, and I have just figured out that I outlived everybody in my family. And my story is that I don't smoke and I don't drink and I eat healthy. Now that I'm older, I do not take any medicine and take some supplements when I need to. And I've lived in a healthy climate, not climate, but in a clean air all my life. My father taught us that a daily walk is most important, and he lived to the age of 84. And both my parents hardly ever needed a doctor. I have no car. I walk. I do yard work. I move around a lot. I live in a two-story house. I pay attention to what food is healthy and what is unhealthy. And one doctor's advice stuck with me. And I've forgotten his name. It was a German doctor. And he said, death lurks in the bowel. And that really made me think. So I see to it that I have a daily BM. And I think you laugh about that.
No, I'm not laughing at you.
But this is really the most important thing. Because then all these poisons that you might have eaten come out every day. So I've probably forgotten the two things. But now I set my goal. Now I'm going for 95.
Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for your call.
Yeah.
Death lurks in the bowel. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, Edith. Take care.
Yeah,
Howard
sounds,
and Leslie?
It sounds like Edith is doing so many things right. I mean, she's active, and it sounds like that's been consistent over her lifespan. You know, she's got plans. She's doing things, and she's now got a new goal, 95. And I imagine when she gets to 95, she'll set a new goal of 100. She didn't mention, social interactions, but I would imagine that she is active in her community and that she has friends that she talks to regularly or interacts with. And I think what she described really epitomizes, balance.
She sounds like an engaged person as well.
She really does.
I'm a fast eater, and my whole life I thought that that was unhealthy, not to mention rude. But you're saying that's not necessarily so. So for all the fast eaters out there, take heart, right?
Yeah, that was one of the funny things that we found, that people say that and joke about that, eat slowly. But we actually had data. Dr. Terman, who started the study in the 1920s, he had collected good information about how fast the children ate. And we put it into one of our statistical survival analysis to see how long they lived, and it didn't make any difference at all. So
go ahead.
Eating slowly
is not
that relevant. But we have lots of other things in the book that really are relevant.
Mark on Facebook, he says, my aunt who lived to 100 said, I eat little, smaller meals, no fast food, and never speak ill of people.
Yeah, well, the not speaking ill of people is probably, as we were just talking about, having good relationships with other people, liking people, being involved with other people. Those are all the kinds of things that you don't really think about. So when people say, well, I do these things, I eat this much, and I don't smoke, but that's the stuff we hear all the time. Mm-hmm. People make lists, do this, do that. But we find it's a lot simpler in some ways. If you get on the right path and you have the right relationships and you're doing something meaningful in your job or your career or your volunteer work, a lot of other things come naturally. People help keep you healthy. Having the right friends is one of the most important things. Look around and see who your friends are, and if they're all unhealthy people doing unhealthy things, that's probably bad. But if they're all healthy people doing healthy things, that's probably one of the best things you can do, one of the best predictors of your health and long life.
In Chapter 7, you address parental divorce and what kind of indicator that is. And given the fact that it's something like 50 or 51% of marriages end in divorce now, what can that tell us?
Well, the parental divorce was the strongest psychosocial predictor for kids of how long they would eventually live. It was very important.
And that's one of the things that we often get asked is, okay, you know, back then that was something of a rarity. It wasn't particularly common. It's so much different today because so many kids are from divorced homes and you know, there's not so much of a stigma as there used to be. But we don't really think that our findings would be different if the study were restarted again today. And we base that on the fact that other contemporary studies that aren't lifespan, so they're not looking at how long people live, but they are looking at things like how people adjust. They're finding very similar things. You see the same sorts of adjustment problems, some of the riskier health behaviors, the problems in people's own marriages that we saw play out in the Longevity Project in these more contemporary samples. And so that leads us to believe that if, you know, kids whose parents divorced in this decade are followed, you know, for their entire lives, that we would probably see very similar lifespan-related outcomes.
But the good news was that in the Longevity Project, the children who did face parental divorce, but by young adulthood had accomplished something, had a sense of being on the right track, had maybe succeeded in their work or had a good feeling about themselves, those children went on to live very long, healthy lives. So it was a risk factor, but on the other hand, there were ways that people recovered and actually sometimes lived longer than those who didn't face parental divorce.
Ernie in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You as a host, I would like to see you a little bit more aggressive, and I'll comment on that in just a second. But I'm pushing 80 and free of any medicine prescriptions, strong on alternative medicine and natural foods and good diets and lots of vegetables and low on the dairy and red meats and so on. And these studies on people, I don't think would be very, it can be very fruitful. I think it'd be a lot more quickly diagnosed if there were studies on different practitioners or providers. And I'll get to my opening comment.
Ernie, we're running out of time. Why don't you stay on the line? I'd love to hear what you want me to be aggressive about, but so just hang in there and thanks for your call. I wanted to get to the issue of policymaking, and you said that policymakers and laypersons alike tend to make two major conceptual errors when thinking about health and longevity. And the first is the emphasis on family biology, and we talked about that earlier. And the second error is our penchant for following lists of health recommendations and when those fail, turning to medications. What as a society, Leslie or Howard, can we do, given what you found in your research?
Well, I think that when we think about what sorts of recommendations to make, it's important to recognize that giving people long lists of things to do, and you know, you see in the news every day there's a new recommendation, you know, coffee's good for you, coffee's bad for you, chocolate's good for you, chocolate's bad for you, you know, eggs are bad, no, wait, they're good. And that gets very overwhelming for people. In addition, some of the things that we really do know are important, like the physical activity, being physically active. People oftentimes have very specific beliefs about exactly how they need to be active. It needs to be X amount of minutes of aerobic activity with my heart rate at such and such, you know, every day. And people get bored with that. People get frustrated. They're unable to continue. And sometimes they get confused when recommendations are competing and contradictory.
Okay.
So what we find in the Longevity Project is that although, you know, certainly there's good health advice out there, the lists don't make a lot of sense. It's much better to focus in on a few major elements that we find are important. And those tend to lead to a sort of cascade of other positive health behaviors and
I'm sorry, Leslie. We've got to end it there. Leslie Martin and Howard Friedman, authors of The Longevity Project, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for listening. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7, NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.